Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, everybody. This is Zachary Johnston, and this is Zach's Whiskey Corner, a special edition of the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where I get to watch my favorite movies and drink some of my favorite whiskeys with people I love in the whiskey industry. And today, we have one of my favorite films of all time from my childhood, Wayne's World. We're going to be drinking one of my favorite whiskeys of 2023 with one of my favorite people from the whiskey industry. And let's first introduce our guest, then we'll leave the whiskey as more of a surprise. So I'm here with Ian Skolkowski from Old Forester. Ian, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Zach. Stoked to be here, man.
Oh, stoked to have you, dude. We just actually bumped into each other the other night randomly at Galaxy Bar and had a great cocktail made with some delicious Old Forester.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great to see you there. Always good to run into you and, you know, people downtown for happy hours. Yeah. We're in the middle of Whiskey Row November. So big brand push and doing a lot of happy hours. So that was a real treat to run into you, man.
Absolutely. And so for the audience listening, Ian works with Old Forester, and that's sort of how we met through, you know, working with the brand. I'm a big fan of a lot of what they do, but especially their special releases. So Ian, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, man, for sure. So I, my current role is brand ambassador, and it's a lot of fun. I get to be the face of the brand. There's a PR element to it. So, you know, making cocktails on local TV sometimes. Some of it's sort of field marketing work, so educating bartenders about our brands and, you know, sort of bringing them into the fold to be Old Forester enthusiasts themselves. But I really got started in the sort of home place of Old Forester at the distillery on Whiskey Row. So most recently, whenever I was there, I was sort of working in and curating the single barrel program, which was a blast. So did that for a little over a year and then moved on to this current role and have been with the brand in some capacity, started in 2018, December. So it's been a fun ride and just enjoy it every day.
That sounds great, man. And since you're the guest, why don't you introduce which whiskey we're going to be drinking with Wayne's World?
Yes. So this is a very special whiskey. This is our 2023 Old Forester Birthday Bourbon.
Nice. That is one of the more coveted bourbons in the whiskey release calendar, I'd say.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is the 23rd release of Birthday Bourbon. I know we'll talk about it a little bit more later, but absolutely. This is very much a coveted whiskey. It's one that people seek out. And so we're very fortunate to have some today to enjoy here.
Absolutely. When you recommended it and you're like, hey, right, if we do this, I was like, Oh, please twist my arm.
Right. Yeah. Easy sell, right?
Oh, for sure. Tell me about your relationship with the good, the excellent Wayne's World.
Man, it's so funny. I had not watched this movie probably since I was in like middle school.
Wow.
And I remember, so when I was sort of coming of age, Austin Powers was big, right? And so my sort of introduction to Michael Myers was those movies and, you know, all of the humor that at that time I caught maybe like 30% of, but still thought it was hilarious and loved his impressions and his sort of spontaneity and delivery. And so he, along with like Jim Carrey, I think of as being like two of the sort of comedy icons of movies whenever I was a kid and growing up. And then actually wasn't until a little bit later that I think, you know, whenever I was like starting to play instruments and play in bands and stuff, because I was really into like classic rock whenever I was in like middle school, high school. And my friends and I think rented this one from the local video store back when those were still a thing and watched Wayne's World. And I don't think I got it as much. And going back and watching it as an adult was just so gratifying because it was really a treat.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a very meta film, really.
Like, yeah.
Like, and it swings for the fences and kind of hits home runs. Yeah. I age myself a little bit here, but I remember vividly going to see this film in Olympia, Washington on a double feature. And the first film was Beauty and the Beast. And then this was the second film.
Wow.
And it was a packed crowd the whole time. And I remember loving it as, you know, a 13-year-old. It was just like hit perfectly for me at my age. I was with my half-sister who was 10 years older than me. So we both would stay up late and watch SNL. So, and this was very my era too. So like late 80s, going to early 90s, Phil Hartman, Mike Myers, Dana Carvey, Farley, you know, all those guys, David Spade. So this was like my, like, you know how things like hit when you're like having your awakening from childhood into adulthood and they sort of like stick with you. And it's sort of like, you know, the same year that Nevermind came out and, you know, sort of that whole, and being an Olympian Seattle kind of helped solidify all that stuff for me. So this is, you know, when I said in the intro, one of my favorite films, it really truly is one of my favorite films. And I appreciate that a lot of that is nostalgia for my, you know, teenhood. I'm not unself-aware of that nostalgia, but yeah, man, that's why I'm really glad, you know, we could just chit chat about this movie and sort of, it's going to be the first episode of the series. And I feel like it's a good introduction to what's to come for the rest of this series. And Zach's Whiskey Corner.
I love it. I love that you had picked something that's kind of just lighthearted and fun that we can kind of, enjoy and talk about.
Yeah. Together, so. I mean, it was be a bit of a slog if we were, you know, doing a Holocaust movie or something.
Right. Like that.
Whiskey and Auschwitz.
Right.
Welcome to Friday night.
Right.
you know, rewatching this fresh as an adult, like, what's your thoughts on this film? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
I'd say thumbs up, definitely, but for such different reasons than the things that I liked it for as a kid. I think that the things that I liked as a kid were, you know, Babes and Schwing, like sort of like funny, you know, references, you know, that, as you said, really land with you when you're in that kind of teenage phase. What really struck me this time was like how much more, and there are like overt references to it, right? How much more it is very much a film about, you know, relationships and, you know, authenticity to oneself and one's sort of true cause, and authenticity to the people who are around you. I was really struck by that in the relationship between Wayne and Garth, but then also just between, like, you know, some off lines from, you know, sort of lesser characters that come out throughout the movie. And I felt that there were some really good character arcs, even for some of the minor characters. So that was really fun to revisit for that reason.
Yeah, it's got an amazing pedigree as well. Like, obviously, you know, Lorne Michaels and Mike Myers are sort of the heart from the SNL side. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was co-written by Bonnie and Terry Turner, who went on to do like 30 Rock from the Sun and that 70s show, which, you know, is, you know, pretty much up there at the pantheon of 90s sitcoms.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, it's directed by Penelope Safaris, who's you know, done some really amazing work. And so there's just this kind of depth to it that I don't really think any other SNL movie quite has, because it goes so far beyond just the sketch and really builds, like you said, this whole world where all, like, there are side characters that truly do have like full arcs, and it's really funny. Like, I wish, like, this movie somehow has that magic trick where it kind of gets funnier every time you watch it, because you notice some stuff and you notice the intricacy a bit more. It's sort of, you know, it's up there for me. It's also just the I guess secondary cast outside of Wayne and Garth, Mike Myers and Dana Carvey. Rob Lowe is phenomenal in this.
He's so good.
He's smarmy.
He's like the perfect foil, right?
Perfect.
And even just thinking about his sort of aesthetic, right? And just how juxtaposed it is to Wayne and Garth, and how he has like the very slick hair and sort of like that, like almost like Armani baggy, like a little bit baggy, but still tailored and very, like, you know, sort of quaff and it's like he's so good at being at leaning into that role, I think.
Dude, it's just like, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but one of the, my favorite jokes in any movie is so subtle, but when he's ordering Chinese food and just pops straight into Cantonese and turns to Tia Carrera, is like, your accent feels a little more like Kowloon Bay than Hong Kong.
Right.
Or than Kowloon Bay. And it's just such a perfect, like, just simple, subtle joke, but.
Yeah.
Just that he does so well by him.
Yeah. He does. He leans into it so well. And then I love the very sort of quick trajectory from sort of Garth realizing when he's like, I don't think Benjamin's very much like us, Wayne. And, you know, it very quickly obviously escalates into one of my favorite lines, which is Garth saying, if he was an ice cream flavor, it would be pralines and dip. I thought that was... That made me laugh so hard some reason. I was like, it's just such a, you think he's going to say like vanilla or something, like he was bland or whatever. And it's, no, it was pralines and dick. I was like, that is hysterical.
Amazing joke.
What's funny is like so many one-off lines like that. Yeah.
But what's funny is like Rob Lowe is technically just doing his job. Like he's not evil, you know, like he's not twirling his mustache or anything. It's more, he's just kind of like, yeah, he's an exec and he's a dick, but also he's got to make this show work for his livelihood.
Right.
It was also sort of interesting watching this again, because like there is this aspect to Wayne and Garth of sort of arrested development that I kind of always attributed to it earlier on. But now looking back, it's like, they're not really arrested. They're fully formed adults and they know exactly who they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's,
go ahead. Sorry. I was just going to say, I love that you say that, because I think you're absolutely right, man. Like, that was something that struck me so much too, was that it's so tempting just to make those assumptions about who they are as characters. And, you know, it seems as though it's setting them up to be that. And then you actually get these moments where they, like, you know, are really, you know, and what struck me is whenever Wayne is talking to Cassandra and is like, And he's learned Cantonese and he's trying to communicate to her and be romantic. And like, and they're like, and he's like quoting Kierkegaard, and like, you know, you don't get the sense that he's just trying to be smooth, right? It's like, he's actually being very authentic. And like, you know, we're seeing a side of him that is, it's just, you know, it's just like a sort of different layer to the onion. And it's like, you know, he loves, you know, rock and parties and like the goofy shit, but then he's also like, you know, actually interested in, you know, substantive conversation and like relating to people and meeting them where they're at. And I found that really endearing, I think, to both of them as characters, both Wayne and Garth.
Absolutely. And also, and this is sort of the genius of the film, with layered it with pure absurdity. Like, there are just absurd comedic beats in this film. And it works in a balance where it's sort of like, I kind of attributed that to like the Steve Martin of it all. Where it's like, you have this, like said Kierkegaard, you have these like real emotions and real character beats, and you know, there's actual growth, and there's depth, but then it's also like, you know, they have a gratuitous sex scene and it literally
flashes
gratuitous sex scene on the screen. And it still works. Or, you know, we'll get to it, the ending, but let's just sort of walk through here and we're not going to do beat by beat, people. We're just going to go over the main plot and, you know, sort of things we love about it. And then we'll get to the whiskey soon enough. Don't worry. So, you know, the film really does kind of pick up on just like the sketch, because the sketch is obviously very isolated to the basement. They'd have huge people come in like Tom Hanks and Aerosmith and all that. But I do love the sort of whole, I guess, opening set piece where you're brought into their world, and you know, they come out of the basement, and Wayne is giving you he's doing narration, but he's talking to the camera, you know, you know, breaking the fourth wall as opposed to just narration over while they do stuff. I like that because, well, maybe it feels a little early 90s to do that, but it feels authentic to who they are, that he would be talking to camera like that. Kind of reminds me in Letterkenny when they just randomly talk to camera and narrate too, which they do very rarely. But and then, of course, I think the big moment of the first act is them in the car picking up their buses to go party.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
it's become such an iconic scene of them. What is it? A little, like, what's that car? Like, not a Hermit, but something like that.
Yeah, it's almost that. I know. I thought it was a Pinto. I don't think it is a Pinto.
Right. It's one of those shit cars from the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's stripped out.
Right. The Mirthmobile, I call it, right?
Yeah,
the
Mirthmobile.
Yeah. One of my favorite things about that scene that I totally overlooked previously and just picked it up this time was, I think his name was like Philip or something, but like their friend who's just absolutely shit-faced, and they go and pick him up, and you know, Wayne has to promise Garth that he's not going to hurl, and then they get him in the car and they're doing the Bohemian Rhapsody thing, and he's like slouched over drunk and like looks like he's can't even keep his eyes open. And then, you know, there are a couple of cutaways, and then it goes back to them singing Bohemian Rhapsody, and he's like fully into Bohemian Rhapsody.
Fully, yeah.
Oh my God, it's so good, because it's just such a funny switch that's turned on you. It's like,
and it's such a true moment though, where you're like really drunk, but then you like get into something suddenly.
Just rally, and, yeah,
yeah, you rally.
Yep.
The power queen.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's also interesting. Like, this isn't about, you know, this isn't a podcast about trivia and stuff, but evidently there is such a massive fight about which song to use in that scene that like Myers threatened to quit the picture entirely unless they let him use Bohemian Rhapsody.
No kidding.
And because he thought it would be true to them to sort of have that reverence for huge stadium rock in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they love Alice Cooper, they love Aerosmith, they love those huge 70s stadium rock bands.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently the studio really wanted like something from Guns N' Roses, something, you know, modern that the kids would listen to. And he's like, listen, man, we're not kids. We're adults. And I think that's valid, because then because that scene has become iconic and parodied, and you know, it technically helped bring Queen back in the 90s. There's a couple books, reports, things written where Queen had sort of faded away entirely in the late 80s. And this song helped like their record sales skyrocket again. Which I always find interesting, but yeah, so they do this wonderful montage of singing the Bohemian Rhapsody. You see all of Aurora, Illinois, and the suburbs of Chicago. You get a nice little montage tour there. Stop and meet with the cop. They give him shit. Cop laps him off. You know,
you spell
bacon. I definitely smell a pork product of some kind. such Gen X. Cringy,
I liked one of my, again, just like stupid little things that made me laugh is that moment, and there are a few other moments like this where they make it, one of them will make a joke like that, and then they like laugh, but like inaudibly, they just like silently kind of like, you know, like, it's just so stupid, but it's just, it's endearing in that way for some reason. I don't know, but
yeah. It's that perfect relationship you have with your best friends where like everything's sort of an inside joke.
Right.
But
right.
The brilliance of this film is those inside jokes are actually funny to everybody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
In most cases.
Yeah.
Then we also get the introduction to the donut shop with Ed O'Neill, which, I mean, this is Ed O'Neill at his like sitcom height. I mean, Married with Children is huge. He's starring in movies, and he just cameos as this batshit crazy donut shop worker. I remember cracking up in the cinema or in the theater when I was like, and Wayne turns the camera and was like, and he works here 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And then Ed starts talking to the camera and Wayne runs back. He's like, hey, only me and Garth are
camera. I'm the only one who can do that. Yeah. No, I love how, and the way he plays it with the dialogue too, man, it's just like, he plays it so straight, and you're right. His dialogue, it's like every time we see him in a movie, he's talking about killing someone like very seriously. And it's such a weird shit that it's like so absurd that you just have to be like, oh my God, like the hell is this guy's deal?
You kill a man in war and you're called
right.
A hero. You kill a man in the heat of passion and they call you a murderer.
Right.
What is happening?
Just so out of place. It's great.
Yeah. It's wonderful because his commitment is so fierce. It's just it's mesmerizing.
Yeah.
Then, you know, we meet some more characters, of course. Wonderful exchange with Laura Flynn Boyle as Wayne's ex-girlfriend, and this honestly became like something we would say for years when we get a present we didn't want. because she brings him a gun rack as an anniversary gift, even though they've broken up.
Right.
And anytime we'd get some shitty gift, we'd be like, a gun rack. I do not have a gun. I would necessitate a rack. Just again, the delivery is just so pitch perfect. I love Makita's diner. The whole scene is just great because again, we're on this sort of like first act journey and we're just meeting everybody still, but all the characters are so well rounded. You know, Laura from Boyle's like, I guess crazy ex-girlfriend for lack of a better term. And I think it's appropriate to use that because there's a whole TV show called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So that out of character there. And from there, of course, we go on to the big sort of meet cute, the big sort of like, you know, inciting incident for Wayne, where we sort of propel on his journey, his love story, when they go to a big club in Chicago. We get a great Chris Farley cameo. And we meet Crucial Taunt, which was, it's definitely a moment in cinema for 13-year-old Zach.
I believe that. I was like, watching it like yesterday in my living room, I was like, God damn. Wow. I can't remember the actress's name, but I was like, she is just ferociously beautiful and so magnetic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just so magnetic. She's the front person and bass player in this band.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. She's pulling off like rock star really well. Like you don't for a second question whether or not she deserves to be on that stage or she's rocking out or not. I can attest to Mattel, well-rounded, but how well-acted these characters are. And you get the, you know, the kung fu moment where Wayne is like shocked into, you know, a cheesy 70s love song and seeing her on stage. And,
right.
That whole sort of like moment. And of course, when she comes off stage, she walks right to the bar next to Wayne because where else would she go?
Right. You know?
But yeah, then it's sort of like the first act sort of ends with an after party and we get more of the characters again. You know, Laura from Boyle comes back, falls through a glass ceiling for some crazy reason. And you get Wayne and Tia Carrera character. What is her name? Cassandra. Yeah. Wayne and Cassandra set up to see each other again and, you know, they're sort of off to the races. We get Rob Lowe. We already talked about Rob Lowe, but it's such a great introduction to him as well, because he's sitting in like his bed in a condo and it's the most 90s yuppie thing ever. And, you know, he's got a girl with him and he's like flipping through TV, literally fishing for something to work on. Like he's ignoring this woman in his bed to find work on television, which I think is a very, interesting way to introduce a character where he's that like focused.
Right. It's so funny that you say that. I didn't sort of like retroactively put those two pieces together, but yeah, that's, you're right. That is absolutely, once we establish that he's a TV producer, it's like, yeah, he's totally scouting, right? Like he has this woman in bed next to him and he's just kind of flipping channels, like very serious, very intent. And I think it's the girlfriend, right? Who kind of stops him on the show and he's like, oh, this show's great. And he like, doesn't get it whatsoever. He's like, you know, what are these idiots doing? Basically, it's kind of lost on him.
Yeah. But she's laughing and she like, it's a bad thing. It's like, well, there's an audience for this. Young people get it. There's something here. I don't have to get it, but I get that people get it. So then, yeah, Benjamin, Wayne and Garth meet at a ridiculous tiki bar with a ridiculous cocktail. And this was another thing that this was funny in 1992. How excited they get over $5,000 both of them before taxes is absurd. But literally dancing and singing, we've got $5,000
for
a solid minute.
Well, I think it's just like, it's just minutes before they have to like take the car, the Mirthmobile to the shop. And I think the bill was like $40 or something. And they're like, $40. And they like scrounge together cushion change basically to like come up with 40 bucks. So yeah, no, but you're right. I absolutely take your point that they're literally dancing in the street about like, you know, $5,000. But that whole scene too, where Rob Lowe is pitching them on the contract and just how he's sort of playing it back of like, you know, when they're like, well, you know, can we take a look at the contract? We're kind of between lawyers right now. But, you know, if we could just have our lawyer look at it. And he's like, oh, sure. You know, that's perfectly fine. I just, you know, figured guys like you, you know, you're not really interested in money. I can just tear up these checks right now, you know, for $5,000. And then they're like, whoa, well, you know, let's back it up just a little bit. And of course, then they sign their lives away to corporate America and, you know, obviously don't read the fine print. But just the way that plays out, I was so fun and so sort of indicative of how different their characters are, right? And how perfectly Rob Lowe plays it. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and I look, so then he goes on a date with Cassandra next, right? Where he's got the licorice peel in the car.
Uh-huh.
He's like, oh, when did you get that? He's like, when we got the money.
Right.
So there is some childishness there. Don't get me wrong, folks.
Yeah.
But, and then he buys a Strat. And there's, again, this whole scene in the music shop is just, it's just gold the whole way through. Yeah. From Cassandra, like, lusting after the Strat, the light Strat, and, you know, it's the Jimi Hendrix sort of Strat with the whammy bar, and him just playing the first chord and the guy running over and stopping him and pointing to No Stairway to Heaven. and then a whole massive drum solo from Dana Carvey, you know, Garth. Thank you. At the end, he didn't really do anything. And then we're back with Benjamin. They're at his condo on the whichever floor. He's talking Cantonese and ordering food and Pepsi Cola and Mountain Dew. And you were doing that joke. He's like pralines and dick. But again, he knows exactly how to manipulate them because he has all access passes for Alice Cooper. And they're completely won over again. Like all that.
Right.
We're between lawyers and they're just, they're done. They're good.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You're right. It's like he's so smooth and knows with everybody, like exactly what buttons to push, right? It's just, yeah.
Yeah. And that's sort of like what's interesting because they're so easy to manipulate in these scenes. And then when they're like standing, which makes it so much more powerful when they do stand up for themselves and, you know, on the show. But they go see Alice Cooper, which is, you know, they actually have a whole scene from the show. And there's the infamous We're Not Worthy scene with Alice in the back. Mm-hmm. Another great Alice Cooper explains Milwaukee. He's like, Milwaukee.
Right.
It's a Native American word for it.
Yeah. He's like very like erudite and like professorly. And yeah, he's like explaining all of these sort of like, you know, tribal dynamics of Native Americans of the region and stuff. And yeah, it's pretty wonderful. Yeah.
It'll be socialism and how it applies. It's a wildly funny turn, Alice Cooper there. Mm. And then, of course, then we sort of like get into kind of the meat of, you know, the conflict of the film because Wayne's World is being broadcast from a studio and it's going to be a real show. Mm-hmm. And they have sponsors, Noah Vanderhoff, which is played by Brian Doyle Murphy, you know, who's hugely famous SNL, you know, Bill Murray's brother, you know, massive comedic career, coming in sort of doing his thing with his very kind of happy to be their wife, who's very excited about everything.
Mm. Yeah.
There's just so many jokes in this set piece. I mean,
yeah,
you just have to trust us.
I think my favorite part of this is, and I can't remember, I maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, where Rob Lowe is sort of trying to explain the sort of corporatization of the show and rationalize why certain things have been done and why the show is changing, because Wayne obviously is seeing, you know, these marked changes in the aesthetic and the, you know, the sponsorships. And he says something like, what is it? Something about like, you know, I will not bow to our corporate overlord or something like that. And he has a box of Pizza Hut and he's like holding the slice and like poses with it. And then it's just like a series of those where it's, you know, like, you know, for the next generation, we, you know, we have to preserve our, and then he holds up a can of Pepsi and it's like, and what a generation it is, you know, like it's just that series of And it's one of those things too, where it's almost like they do it to the point where it's not funny, and then it becomes funny again because it's like five different bits like that right in a row. But that just, and then Garth is decked out in Reebok. It's just like, it's just so goofy and funny. But exactly. Yeah. But I also felt like too, that was a really like kind of a, and I hope I'm not reading too far into it, but I was like thinking about the timing of this and, you know, 1992 and, you know, we're coming out of like the Reagan years and the late Bush senior years and just the general sort of, you know, I think broad reaching corporatization of a lot of aspects of American life. Right.
For sure. Absolutely.
And I was like, wow, you know, this is, you know, pretty early for these kind of, you know, sort of salient points about, you know, compromising artistic integrity and individuality, you know, for the sake of like a corporate sponsor, you know, and I know that others were doing it at that time, but it was, again, it gave some heart and some backbone to the movie, I thought.
Absolutely. And it's this part of that sort of Gen X ethos of like, you never sell out, like never, yeah. You know, you never go corporate no matter what, but then it's like, but the way they sort of present it is, yeah, like you nailed it on the head there. It's just so great. And, you know, like I said, this whole sequence, there's just so much great stuff, from, you know, their crew counting down and like not understanding, like to not be silent when they're doing the two in one silently, you know, just little jokes like that, that are, you know, this little character, beats to, you know, I'm doing the blue screen to the different places where they end up in Delaware and that's the, hi, we're in Delaware.
Yeah. I mean,
that was another thing that just became so prevalent in pop culture for so long. But yeah, it's just a really fun part of the movie where you kind of, you get into the meat and you start to see them, like actually they do start to kind of come out of their shells a little bit and have to like, you know, stand up for themselves. You see, you know, Garth with his gadgets. I mean, he sort of skipped over it at the club before. He's a gadget guy. Then he's like, a hand comes to life and he starts banging on this. Benjamin's trying to explain how things are going to work and change.
Right.
But yeah, it's just, again, it's just a fun sequence where you kind of get them. They're fish out of water, but they're coming in their own and meeting everybody and a lot of fun stuff going on a big set.
And this is also, we're getting to the point too, right? Where Mr. Vanderhoff, right, is the presenting sponsor and he's supposed to come on for the interview and Wayne is like really pissed off about it. And then he's holding up those cue cards and the kind of like beat liquor, like Mr. Smithers-esque character, I think his name is Russell. Russell's great. And he's like, oh great, he's using the cue cards. And then we quickly realize that Wayne has written like these, really deeply offensive messages and like vulgar messages about Mr. Vanderhoff. And my favorite was, you know, it's like they're sitting directly next to each other and Wayne is asking him these questions about his arcade. Just like, so what's the difference between Pac-Man and Miss Pac-Man? And meanwhile, he's holding this sign that the guy can't see that says, my favorite one was, this guy blows goats. I have proof.
I have proof.
It's
such a great joke.
Oh, it's just so funny and like vulgar and goofy and but yeah, him getting sort of the best of the corporate sponsor is like a fun triumphant moment and kind of like a pivotal moment, right? In how the movie progresses plot wise.
Yeah, because I mean it's him standing up for himself and his sort of his artistic integrity and like, yeah, I'll do your corporate sponsor bullshit, but I'm gonna do it my way. Of course that sort of creates the rift between Garth and Wayne, and they have their fight on top of the car waiting for the plane. And, the plane goes over at just the right time so you don't hear, you know, Garth say all the bad, naughty words.
Right.
But then also Benjamin's already moved in on Cassandra and they're doing a music video together with Crucial Taunt. And again, everyone listening, we're not going beat by beat here. Just sort of, you know, going through the broad brush strokes. But yeah, it's funny because like this is where like the meat of the movie really is, and that, you know, he goes back to Cassandra's apartment and she's not there, and it's, you know, he realizes that you know, he does sort of have to take responsibility for his actions, but his actions were right. Like, he wasn't wrong.
Mm.
But it's like, things, just because you're not wrong doesn't mean things don't fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of how it feels, right? Like,
I think so. And I think, this is definitely a moment where both of the sort of primary relationships that he's had and established throughout the film are really sort of called into question, right? Both with Cassandra and Garth. And you're right, it's like kind of a moment wherein he has to make a decision. And even though his actions were not wrong, he was acting by his own values and standards, he's still in some ways sort of let the people around him down, and he has to sort of compromise on those things in a way.
Yeah. And he's kind of like, because when he goes to the crucial talk shoot with, you know, Cassandra and Benjamin's there, and she's trying to hold the stupid snake and it's too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law looks ridiculous because Benjamin's a TV producer, not a music producer. You know, it's obviously like, you know, he's pretending that, you know, he's the boss of everything, but, you know.
Right. And that's great too, because she's like simultaneously trying to play the bass and hold this like massive python, and it's just like not working. And she's just like visibly frustrated juggling these two things. Pretty good.
Yeah. And, we get this sort of like, what Wayne thinks is a heartfelt scene where they literally flash on the screen Oscar bait.
Right, like, right.
You know, him crying and saying, I never learned to read. And she's just like, dude, is that? No, of course that's not true.
Right.
She breaks up with him. Like, she's just like, we're done, dude. Like, you're acting like a little asshole, and you're not thinking of anyone else but yourself.
Mm.
You know, it's her big break, too. I mean, it does ring false because of who Benjamin is, but as far as she knows, like, he's kind of on the up and up.
Yeah.
Until, of course, he's not. The whole third act of this film is like, it's sort of like almost a heist.
The
film becomes this heist where they're trying to get this record producer that Chris Farley told them about randomly that you didn't even really pay attention to, but it comes back perfect platinum payoff of Frankie Sharp, Records. And they know his limousine is going through a certain place, and they know that he watches satellite TV in his limo because he doesn't fly or whatever. And so Garth gets Wayne gets Garth back on his side because Garth, you know, can do technology and hardware and stuff like that. And they want to get Cassandra to the original basement studio of Wayne's World and have her do an audition for Frankie Sharp that they're going to beam straight to his limousine. And even Russell redeems himself, who's, you know, the Smithers to Benjamin. It's kind of a sweet scene where they like hug it out, and you know, he becomes part of the crew properly. And going back to your original point, like, there's actual arcs for secondary and tertiary characters in this. In that, you know, Russell really does help them out, and sort of like, he's kind of a valuable guy because he knows what the hell he's doing. He's a bit of a toady.
You're right. I loved that moment. I that was just such a fun, wholesome kind of moment, you know, whenever Eastgater joins the crew and helps them out.
Yeah. And so, like, again, there's sort of like the heist being, you know, getting the satellite signal to Sharp's limo. You know, you get this sort of like big triumphant moment where, you know, Crucial Tom plays in the studio, and, you know, you see the Sharp limousine turn around, you know, and, you know, obviously we're going to spoil this 31-year-old movie because it's 31 years old, and the end of this film to me is brilliant because there's so few films that do this, but, they fail. Like, Sharp is like, you're not there yet. You're not ready. And, you know, of course, Cassandra's like, Wayne, you ruined my career. And Benjamin's there sort of laughing, and everyone's all bummed out. And just like out of this was, I thought, brilliant when I was watching it. Out of nowhere, first of all, like, Stacy comes in and reveals she's pregnant, and fire starts, burns the house down. It's just all disaster.
Disaster.
So Wayne and Garth come back, and they're like, why don't we do a Scooby-Doo ending? And then it goes, and they have a completely different ending to the movie where Benjamin is Scooby-Doo on mast as an old man withers. And it's just like, wait, what?
Yeah, it's so goofy. And that moment, and then But it is, right? It is. It's jarring because when you first see like the limousine like peeling out and you turning to go back and you're like, oh yeah, of course. Like this is the big moment where she gets signed, and then Graham just come back and be like, yeah, it's, you're not there. It's not it. Is really jarring. So I agree that
it came out of nowhere, or it didn't come out of nowhere. It's earned, but it's also earned in like, that's kind of reality. And that's like, you know, I mean, it goes completely off the rails after that, but still.
Right. Yeah. And then the pacing of it is really fun, right? Because we get the Scooby-Doo ending. We get the happy ending.
The mega happy ending.
Yeah. Yeah. Mega happy. Exactly. Right.
And it's funny because I was a huge fan of Clue growing up. And that had the three endings as well. So I was just like, the second that I was like, oh, they're doing the Clue thing. And I can't recall any other film in that time frame doing that. And it was sort of like such a like aha moment where somebody else had the balls to do this.
Right.
Whether you like the Scooby-Doo ending or the mega happy ending or not, it's still like that took balls to do. Like, huge big budget SNL movie. And they're like, you know what? Not only is the first ending going to be them fail, but we're going to do three endings and they're all going to be equally ludicrous.
Right. I didn't pick up on it when I first watched this years ago, but when I was watching it just last night, I said the same thing. I was like, it's fucking Clue. It's the Clue movie at the end where it's like different end. And it just like, I was so tickled by that.
And the fact that the middle one is literally a Scooby-Doo ending. I mean, come on.
right.
And it's kind of funny, like without getting into Wayne's World too, but like, the happy ending is the real ending at the end of the day. Like, you know, Cassandra does get signed. She, you know, kindles a relationship with Wayne. Marcus ends up with the hot girl from the donut shop that he was fantasizing over. And, you know, we didn't say it before, but there's this brilliant Jimi Hendrix scene where Garth is like dancing to this beautiful blonde girl with her, you know, hair blowing in the wind. That's, you know, very stylized, but works just kind of perfectly for him. And the best part is Benjamin comes in and he's like, you know, money looks great, but that's not everything. It doesn't bring happiness. So ridiculously sappy.
Right.
So it works. Right. It works because you have that Scooby-Doo ending right before it that's so absurd. it makes it all work. And that's the film right there. And it's, you know, 90 minutes of solid gold.
Yes. And I agree. It's so and the length of it too. I mean, it just keeps the pace so tight. And you know, there are moments that are like, you know, pretty clearly improvised, or like, you know, jokes that are just kind of put in. Like there's this random Laverne and Shirley bit that like, but it still feels tightly paced. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't really. There's no point where there's fat or it feels like it's lagging.
Exactly. Like the fact that in a 90-minute film, they could do almost a full on recreation of the Laverne and Shirley opening credit scene.
Right.
And it didn't feel superfluous. Right.
Right.
That's talent filmmaking right there. I was also reading, I know we didn't mention it that much, but that scene where Garth dances to Foxy Lady towards the beautiful blonde in the donut shop. Like they had to do that scene several times because it just wasn't pacing right where it would work. Like, because Garth is a little bit of an innocent, you know, where he's like, you know, he's not a, you know, he's a fully rounded character and he's, you know, obviously a genius with hardware and software and stuff like that, but he's just like a nice quiet guy. And so they had to reshoot that scene a lot to sort of like get that character moment just right where he was still that like nice quiet guy without being too pervy, basically. Because when you watch that, like the way it ends as well with him getting sort of like shot back and hits his head, like shot back to reality, you know, it makes scenes like that work well because they were willing to work those scenes over and over again. They were just right, as opposed to like, oh, we got to get this done. So let's get it done.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is crazy to hear too, because as I was like researching for this, it was shot in like just a little over a month, I think, right? It was like 35 days or something, I think they took to shoot this movie, which sounded like a crazy short period of time for like a, you know, big movie, really, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a I think $20 million SNL Paramount Pictures movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's not some indie film.
Right.
And it also, well, especially Mike Myers and Dana Carvey, but also we mentioned, Ed O'Neill, like these people were at like the heights of their career.
Right.
I mean, Rob Lowe, of course, Rat Pack days, but, Brian Doyle Murray, you know, he's an old pro, but it was like the heights of their kind of comedic powers and really shines through and just the ability where it's, word this correctly, but it's like, it's not rushed, but there's no fat at all. And even like the stupid throwaway jokes, like Robert Packard showing up as the T-1000 looking for John Connor, he's racing to Cassandra, holds up because that film, Terminator 2, is iconic. It's timeless.
Right.
And so even that cameo, which is probably the most 92 thing ever, still holds up.
It still lands. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah.
And so it's kind of funny how well this, for me anyway, how well this film does hold up.
I agree. It holds up so much better than I had expected it to even. And it's just fun, right? It there's something about it that's still spontaneous, even though it is, as we said, a big movie. It's, you know, big stars, relatively, you know, big budget. It's like, it still sort of feels like just dudes having fun. Like, you know, it feels organic, I guess, in a way that I think movies felt like during this time period and don't necessarily feel to me now, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or at least not movies of this scale, right?
Right. And also, I mean, let's be honest, there are a lot of movies from this era, especially comedies, where there is so much cringe in just the jokes they chose and the parodies they chose that, you know, that finished their time. There's nothing I found like cringy about any of the comedy. Like there's no, you know, it's an overused term, but you know, there's no punching down. There's no sort of like bashing.
Yeah, that's true.
It's all really, you know, it's just really like just timeless sort of comedy. Oh, the car, Murphmobile, is an AMC Pacer. Which, AMC. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's a random ass car.
That is a super random car.
So, you know what? That's the film. Let's get into the whiskey. And I'm going to let you take over here and tell us about the 2023 birthday bourbon from Old Forester.
Absolutely. Yeah, man. So this is an expression that is released once a year by Old Forester, September 2nd, every year, our founder, George Garvin Brown's birthday. And it was actually the first vintage age statement bourbon on the market back in 2002. So this is the 23rd release that we're enjoying this evening. It's 96 proof. So these are proofed year by year, just based on what that particular year, that particular batch tastes best at, as determined by our master distiller, Chris Morris, master taster, Melissa Rift. So 96 proof, this particular one is 12 years old. And there's not information. Some previous years we have had information about what warehouses and things like that. Kept it pretty general this year. But like all releases of birthday bourbon, to me, this really gets that rich, oaky, still has the classic Old Forester caramels, fruit.
But it is some velvet on the nose.
Yeah.
You get a little bit of, you know, a little bit of like red chili in there, like a little oak spice. But it is vanilla, velvet, and caramel. Like,
yeah, that it does. It has a really decadent nose, really rich. Yeah.
It's like if you could smell silk and feel silk as a smell, it'd be this nose.
I love that. Yeah.
Well, cheers.
Cheers, man. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And that silkiness delivers on the palate as well with just this wonderful sort of layer of, it's interesting is the vanilla comes late. So it's like you get in with like a little bit of like spiced apple, a little bit of wood spice, and then that caramel comes back. And then it kind of, that caramel builds towards like this creamy vanilla mid palate that gives you this just lush finish.
like slush with like a little note of cherry tobacco on the end, a little note of pear brandy on the end, and with that vanilla creaminess underlayer, buttercream, creme brulee.
I love the creaminess of this year's release. That is definitely a word that I've used to describe this one. It's so classic Old Forester. That kind of exhale or that finish with that tobacco note that you had mentioned, you know, when we get these extra aged expressions, it's just like, it's such a treat to get that extra little bit of, you know, kind of earthy, you know, tobacco-y, leathery, that we get on some of these. And it really comes through on this year's release to me on that finish. It's really nice.
Yeah, and going back into it a second time, I get a little hint of a floral note. It's kind of maybe like an orange blossom. But it's very faint. It's sort of like, it's just like, it's the nose going a little bit further. And then when you take that sip and you get a little bit more of that kind of dark spice bark, like buds, like clove buds and allspice berries and proper, you know, cinnamon bark sheets and things like that. So it's not brown and it's not really dry either, because you still have that rich creaminess. But it's not quite an eggnog either. You know what I mean? Where they get that eggnog spice, but it's kind of like in the mid ground there, where it's kind of like mulled wine or hot apple cider spice, you know?
Yeah. I could see that. I definitely get some like sort of fig, you know, some of that, you know, fig date kind of thing going on, which I think complements then that mulled spice note that you're talking about really nicely.
So we kind of have to address the elephant in the room because it's birthday bourbon.
Yeah.
You know, how do you guys release this and like, how does it go out in the world?
Yeah.
No, that's go try it.
Yeah, man. No, that's a great question. So the sort of most public facing version of the release that we do currently is the online lottery leading up to the release date, I should say. So, if you sign up for email with Old Forester, you'll be alerted to when the lottery opens up. Obviously it's closed for this year since we've already passed the release date, but there will be a number of bottles held at the distillery in downtown Louisville. And you know, just like any other lottery, if your name gets picked, you know, you're golden. You can come in and buy a bottle. So that's kind of the most viable way. Otherwise, always keep an eye, you know, I do this. I'm sure you do this, Zach. And I know some of the whiskey loving public are sort of training themselves, if they've not already done so, to do so, but always scanning the back bar and seeing what you can find. That, you know, you never know where you can find a special bottle on the back bar. And this one, I think, is so appropriate because it has birthday in the name, right?
Giving you
an excuse on your birthday to splurge a little bit, enjoy a pour of it. My birthday was last week, so I cracked this one open. And it's really special release. So
yeah, I think that gets lost in the mix sometimes, because, you know, these special releases, like, they're very fleeting, you know.
Yeah,
how it is. It's a special release. It's not supposed to be everywhere. But you also allocate out to, you know, bars and restaurants who have contracts with Old Forester. So you will see this in really good high-end bars, really good high-end restaurants, you know, that have, like you said, look at that back bar. Probably going to see one back there if you have a nice whiskey bar in your neighborhood, where you might see one of these. And again, it's right there on the label. It's a special for a special occasion. And so, yeah, it's going to cost a little bit more because that's, you know, the way of them breaks. Mm. But it is so unique. Also, it's unique year to year. Like 2022's birthday bourbon, very different from this. Like, I'd have to go back to my notes, but I don't remember that creaminess coming through quite as much. I remember it being a little sharper. Maybe a little grassier. Again, I'd have to go back in my notes. Likewise with the 2021, like, there was a difference there. Right? I kind of remember that being a little more caramel spice forward. So there's a lot of fun, I think, in, you know, when you do go and see this bottle on the back, or ask about the vintage, because they might have one or two or three, and you can kind of taste them side by side and get a sense of how much work is being put into each one of these releases per year. You know, like Chris and Melissa did this year with,
know, with this one is something truly unique to this vintage.
Yeah.
And so again, I know it's hard for people out there listening when, you know, there's an elite whiskey where, you know, you can kind of get frustrated with accessibility, but not everybody gets to buy a Daytona Rolex either, and not everybody gets to wear, the real Jordan ones. And, not everybody gets a Supreme sweatshirt when they want a Supreme sweatshirt. The difference being is you can find this in bars and restaurants and you can get a pour.
Yeah.
And it's not impossible.
Mm-hmm. And it's, and to that point too, it is, right? It's like, it is, as you said, you're going to pay a little bit more than you'd be paying for another pour, but, whiskey's for drinking and enjoying with people and for special occasions. And, I'm as guilty of it as anybody is kind of the FOMO with some, special releases that are from other brands.
Cause
an enthusiast first, right? But, when it comes down to it, I work in the industry, my kind of day-to-day bourbon would just be Old Forester Signature 100 proof. It's like, I agree. I think it's a matter of enjoying it. And, especially if you can patronize a really good whiskey bar that's in your area, for a special occasion with somebody special, that's really the best way to do it. So,
I love this year. This is going to be definitely my top of favorite bourbon of the year, but also, and this gets talked about a lot less, but the President's Choice this year from Old Forester was just showstopper.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, man. So President's Choice is a really special product. It was actually the first commercially available single barrel bourbon back in 1962, I believe is the year.
I believe the first one started with a B. I'm kidding.
Yeah. A lot of people believe that. A lot of people like to call me out and say that. I know your stuff, it's kind of cool because it is. It's kind of not as widely talked about, I think in part because it was a brand that we ran during the 60s, I think the early 70s as well, really during bourbon's sort of, peak heyday as a spirit. And then, stopped subsequently producing it whenever the demand fell off, and then only reintroduced it in 2018, whenever Campbell Brown was the president of the company, whenever we, opened up the Old Forester distillery to the public. And that was the point at which Campbell started picking individual single barrels and offering them. And really up until this past year, they were just sold in Kentucky. And the vast majority of them were sold at the Old Forester distillery. That has since changed because we do a direct to consumer. So if you sign up for the Old Forester emails, there'll just be random releases where you can get an email, click the link. And we're now shipping to several states throughout the US.
Nice.
So definitely keep an eye out for that. If you're an Old Forester enthusiast and you want to get your hands on a bottle of President's Choice, that would be the way to do it. And as you said, Zach, it's really, really killer juice. Usually those are, pretty close to barrel strength. We're looking at the 110, 115, sometime 120 proof range. And then right in the neighborhood, just, knocking on the door of the birthday bourbon, year, in terms of you're looking at 9, 10-year-old, sometimes 11-year-old whiskey, single barrel. That are going into those President's Choice releases.
And then, so just to sort of round it off, rule of three, since we're watching movies and comedy, King of Kentucky then is sort of obviously a different label, still Brown-Forman, still Louisville, but it's the ABV, longer aging, but from the same warehouses.
So that's correct.
It's a sort of like a sibling, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And King is, God, that's such a special product. And, if I had infinite resources and access and everything, I would love to do a President's Choice birthday King of Kentucky plate, because the different flavor that it takes on, that our distillate takes on at the 15 to 16 year mark that you're getting into with King of Kentucky, or 18 year in the case of one of last year's releases, it gets so much of this interesting, you know, like what the cognac folks call like rancio, you know, that like oxidized oak and like almost like menthol and just like big tobacco and like, you know what I'm talking about. We had some King of Kentucky together, not that long ago. Yeah. The 15 year. And, God, it's just, it is, it's just, they're all so special and they're all so different. And I think it's a testament to, really, I mean, where the industry is at, but also just our ingenuity. And, you know, the ingenuity of people like Melissa and Chris, who are on the front lines of making these products, you know, and, King of Kentucky is fantastic.
And there you go, folks. I mean, we got the holidays coming up here. Treat yourself, get yourself a Triple Flight Birthday Bourbon 2023, President's Choice 2023. Top it off with a King of Kentucky 16-year-old, and you will have a trio of masterpieces from ground and Louisville, Kentucky, let me tell you. Yeah. So let's sort of wrap this up. What are your final thoughts on Wayne's World? Is it something you're going to watch again? You feel like it is going to hit the rotation?
You know, I want to recommend this to my friends. Something that I like tried to champion just as a human being is what I call just like healthy male friendship. I think that like so much of being an adult male, and especially for like our dad's generation and granddad's generation, was very stoic and very much based on solitude. And I just think that, you know, as the world becomes kinder, hopefully, you know, that's something that we can move away from and move more towards community. And I think that was really the centerpiece of this movie and the thing that I most enjoyed about it. And I think Russell, the character who we joked about a little bit, actually had a line at one point in the movie where he said, and I learned that something like healthy platonic relationships can exist between adult men or something like that. So without being too sentimental, I was like, I want to recommend this to some of my friends who I stay in touch with, you know, and, you know, because it's a nice celebration of friendship in that way. And I appreciated the wholesomeness of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a really good way to put it. Like it is a wholesome movie in the end. Like it really is, you know, which you would never guess from an SNL movie from the early 90s, especially one that does dip into absurdity so deeply. And yeah, that's just it. Like this is sort of, you know, this film for me became kind of a litmus test throughout the years where if you're going to be like really deep friends with someone, you know what I mean? Where you'd watch it and you'd be like, yeah, they get it. Like, we can hang.
Right.
but then that plays into what you're talking about. Like, you know, this is like, it is a film that's about bonding with people. And that's sort of the beauty of it and why I think it sort of transcends generations and still holds up and still has fans. And, you know, new fans still come to it. I mean, we just passed Halloween. You know, my feed was filled with people still dressing as Wayne and Garth. And it's been 31 years. And that's kind of impressive.
Right? Yeah.
That it's still that permeation of the culture has lasted that long. And it is impressive. Also, a birthday bourbon has permeated the bourbon culture and become such a cornerstone and lasted that long. Ian, thank you so much for doing this. I'm glad we were able to watch and talk about such a fun movie, but also drink such a beautiful whiskey. Can you tell the audience where people can find you, where people can find your whiskey, where people can find Bill Forrester? And,
absolutely, man. Yeah, and thank you so much again for having me. It's been a blast. You can find me on Instagram at imbibe with Ian. There are like underscores between imbibe and with. And yeah, you get the idea. You'll find me. But and then Old Forester is just at Old Forester. Follow us. Look for those special releases. Enjoy our products with your friends and with your family during this wonderful holiday season.
Absolutely. And for me, you know, this is Zach's Whiskey Corner for the Film and Whiskey Podcast. But follow me at ZTP Whiskey on Instagram or Uproxx.com, where I write whiskey reviews every single day. We'll see you all then. Thank you, everybody.